Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil and welcome to Q&A number 6. I just looked it up. The first one was 340 days ago, as of this recording, probably when this is released, almost a year ago. So we've done this for a while. So by now, if you've been watching this for a long time, you know the drill. If you're new, this is a session where people send us questions. I answer them to the best of my abilities for your enjoyment and for my fulfillment, because I really, really like doing this. So, sit back, relax, enjoy. Beyond coding. So the first one, what do you think about the Dutch IT market? Interesting. In terms of salary ranges and value given to engineering efforts. A difficult one, because I think it really depends on what type of organization you are in NL. What we've seen since COVID is that more and more international organizations have kind of started hiring within the Netherlands. Now, nowadays, the market is kind of in a slump, but especially a year ago, 2 years ago, it was more so booming. So if you are within an organization that is more international, you know the big tech firms, you know organizations that, I mean, have a little bit more hierarchy, have a little bit more people, but they usually also have more pay. Now, what I've seen is those organizations within NL are kind of on the higher end of what they value engineering efforts, especially if tech is their core domain. Not if it's part of their core domain, but if it's specifically their core domain. That means your engineering efforts, by virtue of you creating software, they get a return on investment that is usually X amount your salary. And if that X is higher, then your salary can also be higher. Now, it depends on the type of work you do, and usually that is if you create money or if you get money. If your company makes money with software, that multiplier is higher. In consultancies, because it is working with people and you're not creating software directly, but the consultancy company is getting money by virtue of offering consultants, you're not really creating software and making money with that software. You're making money with the people that offer that consultancy, There, the margins are different. The multiplier is different. The model is different. So your salaries might be lower. But what I really enjoy, because I'm employed at a consultancy company, is that you get benefits beyond just the monetary value. We get knowledge exchanges, which we have every month. So 12 sessions a year. We have innovation days, which are comparable to hackathons. So 6 days out of a year, you get to hack away. I get time and investment to do this podcast. I'm not sure if that would have happened in a product company, in a SaaS organization, stuff like that. Now, within those kind of different business models and different multipliers, I feel like NL is up and coming, maybe more so up and coming, values engineering efforts quite highly. London is a bit higher. The US is, I think, still the highest, or North America, I should say, even. But the discrepancy between income there is just higher. So highly intellectual work is valued more as well. So engineering efforts are valued maybe more than they would be. However, life-work balance is very much different as well. So with anything, take that into consideration as well. If people pay you a bigger sum, they might expect more of you as well. So value that in your judgments for applying at companies. This question usually comes from a place where a person is not feeling valued at their current job, which is a hard place to be at. I've been in that position as well, and it comes down to a decision. Do you fight for people to value you more or what you think you're worth at, or do you peek your hole into the job market, should I say peek your head out of the hole to the job market and see what you're valued there? Again, currently the job market is quite rough when it comes to people that are more early in career. I'm not sure how it is for more senior positions, but it can never hurt to see what other people value you at. It's just very hard to jump, then take the plunge and see what it is on the other side. So just wanted to end off with that. How do you manage your time, especially when you're learning something that is out of your expertise? Now, I can distinguish this between learning on the job and learning off the job. And mostly learning on the job is just by virtue of solving a problem you haven't solved before. That might lie still within your expertise, but if it's outside of your expertise, you require some research. How I do it and how we do it within our team is we time box that research because there's deadlines, there's time constraints. In an ideal world, you could research infinitely, but this is not the ideal world. There's usually value that needs to be added for a delivery within a certain time constraint. So we time box it. Let's say we say 4 hours to research X solution versus Y solution versus another one, maybe bring more options to the table. That is usually how we do it. And we make sure within that time box, we learn enough to make an educated guess. Now, making those decisions, you can still make the wrong decision. And continuously throughout development, you can evaluate if your decision was the correct one. So then you learn on the job more so. When it's off the job, I am horrible with planning. I'm horrible with time management-ish. So when I'm learning something, if I truly enjoy it, yeah, it's hard to stop for me. That's me as a person. I go down a rabbit hole and curiosity drives me, and that usually brings me far. Till I have to pull myself out or someone else has to pull me out, for example, to get dinner or to go to bed, something like that. I'm not sure if that fully answers your question, but there's a lot to learn. I feel like if you don't like learning within this field, then it's a hard one. So find a way that works for you, whether that's video content on YouTube, audio content in the form of a podcast, blogs, or newsletters when it comes to written content, or just some practical experience, you doing demos, taking courses and doing hands-on stuff. There's different ways of consuming and learning. So find whatever works for you and I think you'll be fine. Hypothetical. If you were just hired at a company and tasked with building a new team, how would you go about doing that? Obviously, the team needs to solve a problem. Do you use any frameworks? Have any experience with that? Now, I have to preface this because I haven't actually done that. And there's going to be a lot of it depends. Obviously, the consultant says it depends because it really does depend on what the problem is. I'm a big believer in that small teams can execute and align on a mental model way faster than big teams. So I would definitely start small as possible, and trust the people that I bring on board first and foremost, because they need to be within the team. They need to be able to execute. Probably if I'm the only person within the team and I'm the manager, I'm going to be contributing as well, which is a benefit of having someone with technical expertise kind of starting out within that team as well. But if the idea is to grow multiple teams, then obviously at some point your hands-on component goes more so out of it and is more delegated to the people within that team. But it starts with trying to figure out what we need to do and what the timelines are. Now, if it's not realistic deadline-wise, and I saw a question, we'll get to that in a bit, what realistic deadlines mean, then we have to challenge that. But let's say the deadline is realistic, and I believe we can solve it with a certain team. We have to figure out how to or self-organize. And the only way I can do that is by bringing people on board that have done that, that have kind of trailblazed within a team, that are really good at bringing something from zero to one, so building up something from scratch and having done that before, I think will make the difference in doing that again. I right now am on a project where I've done that for the first time, and luckily I've done that twice in the same project, which is really, really nice because we bring learnings from the one into the other. But I've noticed that is a skill that you need to be able to learn. And for me to do that within a new team to deliver, I would like people that have the experience of starting something from scratch, not going into analysis paralysis, knowing what to use based on the requirements that we have. See, we have to gather that from the organization. But then I can fully place my trust in people to execute on that. I would be a bit more cautious hiring people that have not done that. So obviously it depends on the hiring process there. But those would be my requirements. When it comes to the technical skills, usually there's a cloud component. Usually there's a software programming language component. And usually there's a domain component. When it comes to the domain, I expect people to be very, very curious and hungry for knowledge in how things work in our organization, in our market share, in the domain that they enter in. When it comes to the technical skills, cloud-wise, it doesn't really matter if it's Google or Azure or AWS. Obviously, there's specifics, there's learnings, but I would emphasize that less within a hiring process. And when it comes to the technical skills, the programming language, I would look at that, but I would also look at the confidence that someone can bring in kind of that polyglot mindset, that someone can pick up a language just by virtue of having done that in the past as well. I would put trust in that. And I think that shines through in a conversation you would have with someone. I like that hypothetical. I hope it kind of answers the question. I haven't done this before, but it's a fun hypothetical nonetheless. How do you know when a deadline is not realistic, especially when you are a junior? Now, deadlines are interesting because they can be placed based on estimations. So within the team or within you as a person, you can be like, okay, for all the work that needs to be done, I think it's going to be X amount of days. Or maybe you do story points and you have a history of how long it takes you to deliver, how much you can deliver within a sprint. Doesn't really matter. It's based on an estimate. So let's say it's half a year down the line. Usually if it's based on estimates, that deadline is set and it needs to be reevaluated based on how fast you go. And there's a few knobs you can tweak within adding more people, but adding more people does not solve the problem, yet it is still what I see in the market or within some projects. Someone has always said to me, you cannot, how do you say that? You deliver a baby within 9 months or you deliver a baby in 9 months. Nine people cannot deliver a baby in 1 month. And I love that analogy because it holds true for the team size in there as well. So keep that in mind. If it's not realistic, you have to reevaluate it based on your previous history of working towards that goal. Now, if you have 6 months down the line, you can do that because you have the time and you have to set the expectation with regards to the deadline. Now, when it is not set based on estimates or expectations in that way or previous history or someone saying, well, I think it's going to be X days, then it's just put in place. And then you have to be like, okay, if this is the deadline, you can do this in any case, even with estimates. If that is realistically the deadline, we have to release due to market constraints, due to business constraints, due to a marketing campaign. You can always tweak with what you will deliver. So what is going to be the MVP and what is really, really necessary? Really, really necessary. Because some features people think are necessary, but usually they tend not to be used or they tend not to be necessary. So from your role as junior engineer or even regular engineer, doesn't really matter. From your role within the delivery team, you can challenge what is being delivered. If you don't think people are going to use it, if there's no research done that people will use it, then you can argue that. You can always challenge that and you have to trust your business, your product owner to defend that or to be able to defend that. If they say, just do it because we think it's valuable and this is the deadline, that is not a good environment to be in. Especially from my point of view, I'm a person that needs to understand. I think more and more, it's one of my core values. So if that is not being explained to me, I don't think I would be able to perform effectively and to the best of my abilities, because that's always going to sit in the bottom of my head. If I'm going to build something that I think no one will use, it's just going to tear me down. So especially if you're from the other side, the non-engineering side, have the patience, allow people to ask questions and explain to your best, to the best of your abilities, and be aware that what you think might be true or what you think might be useful might not actually be useful in practicality. So also acknowledge when you're wrong and have that open dialogue and equal level of conversation within the team, because then at the end of the day, you will deliver a better project. If you throw a problem within that team rather than just feeding them solutions, together with shared minds, you'll solve the problem better at the end. Tweak the scope, move the deadline. You can do either things or not deliver. But yeah, those are kind of the knobs. Which strategies do you suggest to overcome imposter syndrome, and how do you prevent being paralyzed due to failure? Fear of failure. Mess that up at the end. In any case, the only way I can answer that is kind of from my own perspective, because I think this is very specific, is very personal. And part of the strategy is not just about you. It's also about the environment and the other people. I joined this organization, Xebia, and I had never applied here because the bar for entry was always 4 or 5 years of work experience. And I didn't have that. Now, through a roundabout way, I got in. I got through all the recruitment phases, all the interview rounds, and I got in. And just by virtue of not meeting that bar, knowing what it was on paper, because I used to work with consultants in the past, especially from Xebia, I knew what that bar was, and I knew I didn't meet the requirements. So the feeling of not belonging, just by virtue of on paper, work experience-wise, I did not belong. I knew there was something wrong, but still I got in. I felt really lucky to get in. And I also felt like an imposter because of that. The people around me were always really, really good. And I looked up to them. I wanted to catch up to them. I wanted to grow to that level. Now, realizing it's not about catch up, it's more so about growth, is kind of step number one, because they had all grown and they are all their own people. And I'm never going to be fully 100% like someone, because I am my own person. So it's not about catch up, it's about growing and comfort and bringing something to the table. Now, realizing what I could bring to the table, I think that it took a while, but I realized what I brought was not technical expertise, it was something else. it was clarifying for requirements, or it was talking about and trying to optimize how we work together as a team, or pointing out when people do not understand each other. Well, they really think they do, but they're talking about two different things. Or even when they do understand each other, they're still arguing, and it's kind of a waste of time. Me being able to point that out, having that open dialogue, helping people realize what we need to do, or that we actually do understand or do not understand each other, that helped the team out in the end. And it took a long, long time and a lot of reflection, and also asking for feedback from my colleagues to realize what my value is within the team. Now, it's different every time. And especially when it comes to technical expertise and feeling kind of a feeling of imposter or being an imposter there, what really helped was working together with people on a more pair programming sense. So I would be stuck with my task, and they knew I would be stuck because we were a very, very small team starting out, and they would offer help almost immediately when they had kind of the feeling that I would be stuck. I've had many conversations and they wanted me to ask for help earlier and sooner, even though I thought that I could do it. And I probably could do it. But if it takes me 5 minutes to ask for a question or half an hour of a pair program session versus a day of my own time, then for the team, what is most effective if I ask those questions or if we do it together. And realizing that really alleviated a lot of stress. I'm not a person that gets stressed out easily, but doing something you've never done before when stakes are high, when you work with people you look up to, for me, that was a stressful environment. And how they broke it down, my colleagues, that's why I say part of the strategy is not just you, it's also the people and the environment. How they broke that down by working together with me, making sure I felt safe. I think that's the only reason that it went away. Because based on that, I could learn from them. They could help me out. It was an opportunity for them to teach. So they got better at the teaching aspects. And I grew tremendously. And because of that growth, because of seeing kind of where I started from and what I could do now within a really short time, like when I say short, people say, oh, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. No. It was months down the line from project to project, which helps if you're at a consultancy company because you can do that. It was really, really fast. And I think that's one of my fondest kind of journeys within my career. I think it makes sense because it was kind of very early on. Growing incredibly fast, learning from people that I really looked up to. At some point, the feeling of being an imposter went away, and I accepted that I'm not on their level. I might never, ever be on their level, but I'm on my own path, and that is fine. We don't need to compare. I'm going to compare myself to a few months ago, and I am crushing it versus a few months ago, and that's the only comparison that matters. So yeah, it's a lot of it has to do with your environment. If you're not in an environment where people cooperate with you, will people work together with you, will people take the patience and explain concepts that you do not understand. Maybe you think you should, but even if you think you should, allowing someone to explain that or being open and being like, I don't understand this fully yet, the environment needs to be open for that, for everyone to be able to grow and to be comfortable with not knowing the unknown. In any environment, you're not going to know any unknowns, basically. Even in an environment where you're the expert, you might not be the expert, and you might have to acknowledge that some stuff you don't know and other people need to help you with that. It's all based on the environment. And as soon as that's a safe environment, it's a good environment for you to grow. And I feel like slowly those feelings of feeling like an imposter will kind of ebb away as well. Is it possible to succeed in the programming field if you have ADHD? Do you know someone in the field that has it, and what strategies do they use to be able to focus? I think I know someone, oh, I definitely know someone, and the first strategy that comes to mind is they close everything that might be able to distract them on their laptop, they put on music, they blast the music, and they start programming. I feel like at least the people I've worked with, one person in particular, always made sure that when he was in focus mode, nothing could take him out of that. And even to a fault where we would have a meeting and no one would be able to reach him because he was just, well, he forgot about the meeting and he was focusing. I feel like being mindful of what your distractions are, your way of working, like it's hard for me to say because I don't have ADHD, but being aware of that and accommodating for that in your day-to-day, in your way of working, is going to make you laser focused on what needs to be done. And it's going to make you a really, really good engineer, a really, really good programmer, a really, really good person to work together with in a team as well. That person in working together with me also sometimes has zero patience for kind of my learning process, which is also why he navigated more towards doing the thing together, right? If stuff needed to be done, he thinks I could do it faster. He would usually help me do it. And by helping me do it, it would alleviate some of the feelings of being alone, being isolated, working on something that I don't know yet, really struggling with that. And maybe I didn't realize that, but he did help me realize that at the end. Now, kind of through a forceful way, because this person is very specific, but in any case, it has nothing to do with ADHD. I think people that have ADHD and are able to find a way of working that works for them can obviously thrive within this field, just like any other person with non-ADHD. I don't see any issues with regards to that. At least I have not seen any issues with regards to that. But honestly, I don't think there are any. You talk to people about burnouts. Do you have any experience with that? Have you ever come close to burning out? Any experience? No, I have not had a burnout. I don't think I've come to a point where I had to drop everything and just recharge completely for weeks. There's nothing wrong with that. I have not come to a point like that. And I feel very fortunate because I do feel like I've come close. Like I had this conversation with Sergey and it always stuck with me. This is episode 2, by the way, and I think you can still find it on YouTube. He explained the burnout feeling, one of the first symptoms, as kind of feeling like you're in a microwave and this microwave is beaming on your chest and you have this uncomfortable feeling breathing and it's just compressed completely and you can't get rid of it. That was the one and only symptom that I felt. And it was when I would come back from a weekend, for example, and I would not feel recharged. I would still feel that feeling over and over again, day in, day out. I used to have, because I've now stepped out of it, a second YouTube channel as well. And at the highest working point, I would have to create three videos a week, one for the podcast, two for the other YouTube channel, and then day-to-day consulting. And I still wanted to deliver two videos for the other YouTube channel. I still wanted to deliver one video for this YouTube channel. And that meant that every Saturday morning, I would have to record two videos for the other one, then also do the editing, have a bit more of a backlog. So sometimes work more, sometimes work less. And for this one, find guests, do the whole shebang and the editing, as well as a busy consultancy assignment. Sounds like a whole lot because it's basically like at least two jobs, maybe three. That's debatable, three. I'll label it as two jobs. And then friends and family and a partner at home and feeling of not delivering enough, not doing enough. Like it was not a great place on a mental level. And I had to acknowledge that. It basically was a conversation with my girlfriend and I saying that every night you work, it's hard to realize because I love working. And every night I had to work. And that feeling of like uneasiness in my chest, it never went away. So I had to advocate within my organization to get budget to edit this podcast. I made the decision, and that was more so recently, to not do the other YouTube channel anymore. So I didn't have to do the recordings. I didn't have to do the video editing. There was a period where we went from two videos a week to one video a week, but that was just kind of treating the symptom. I had to step out of it for my own mental health. And last weekend, actually, Roth in the back asked me, "What'd you do this weekend?" I didn't really do a lot, and I really recharged. And that is kind of a new feeling. Last weekend also, the weekend before also, that feeling in my chest sometimes is still there, but it's going away. And I think it going away and me having more mental space is a really good symptom that I'm not heading towards a burnout anymore. I think you can do it. I've done it for a long time. You can work yourself to the bone. And then probably depending on, I don't know what factors, maybe how much you've endured in the past work-wise, you can endure that for a period, long or short, but at some point you'll not be able to do that anymore. Just by virtue of you growing older, mentally more being more fatigued, or even physically, you might not, like you cannot withstand that for a long, long time. So I'm happy mentally I have more clarity. I let go of some things that I genuinely loved, which were painful, but at the end, my mental health is a priority. And I always said it's a priority, so I also have to act accordingly. That is the only experience I've had kind of moving towards a burnout. That's a hard one. I hate letting go of things I love, but sometimes for my own sake, you have to do that. I have to do that. What are some do's and don'ts for people that would like to start their own podcast? Do start a podcast if you genuinely like listening to podcasts. Don't start a podcast if you generally don't like listening to podcasts. It's an obvious one, but I've talked to people, opportunities for me to come on as a guest to podcasts, and maybe this is my point of view, but if I ask, like, do you like doing podcasts? I expect, I love doing podcasts to a certain degree. I might not like blah, 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 or I might compromise with so-and-so, but I love doing it. That's what I want to hear. That's someone, for me, that is genuine about doing this podcast. If I hear, man, it's a lot of work. Do you like it? Nah, I mean, it's a lot of work. Then I'm like, maybe I don't want to be involved. But in any case, I feel like the best people to start a podcast are great listeners. You have to be a listener to be able to improve whatever you're creating. And at some point, if you really love listening, you might get really good at speaking as well. Because you're going to listen to your own voice. You're going to listen to your own episodes. You're going to cut out all the stuff you don't like. And just by virtue of doing that, the quality level is going to be better and better and better. Now, what you don't want to do is postpone it until you think a topic is perfect, until you think your way of speaking is perfect, until you find the perfect guest. Because the art of doing a podcast, and I think that is true for most content creation, is consistency over time. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. I mean, you have seasons, but then are still, it's a marathon. It might be multiple marathons, but it's still a marathon of content creation. And you have to be able to do this kind of over and over and over again. And it's not about your single dots of quality. It's about an average line of quality and you being able to incrementally improve your overall average. I feel like if you're not, how do I say that? I feel like if you have thoughts of starting a podcast, just try it. Record 3 episodes. What is 1, 2, or 3 episodes of you talking to a friend, you talking to a colleague, you talking to a microphone in front of a camera, if you want to do video podcast, you're not going to lose out on that. What you will gain is kind of clarity. Is this fun to do? Do you enjoy doing it? Do you enjoy speaking your mind, having those conversations? Are they hard? Do they cost effort? Do they drain you? Do you not like them? Then don't do it. You don't have to do it. If you like doing this, then there's nothing stopping you from doing more. Obviously, don't do too much because you should also stop yourself from doing more. But if you want, you can do it. I would also say don't invest in all the most fancy equipment. If you look at episode number 2, because 1 is not on YouTube, if you look at episode number 2, that is just 2 cameras, tripods, 2 microphones. We did have really, really good microphones, which are basically these ones to start off with. Also, all the equipment is always in the description below, so check that out. I'm not affiliated. I don't get any stuff. It's just for information and SEO. But in any case, we started out with really good microphones. I think you can find a really good microphone recording your car because the audio setup there is really, really good. You don't need video when it comes to a podcast. When it comes to writing, you can just start writing. You don't even have to publish it. Figure out if this is for you. Are there any other don'ts? Don't pay people for coming on your podcast. That is not a thing. I thought that would be a thing. You don't have to pay anyone. People love coming on and having a conversation. Be genuine. Be authentically yourself. That's the only way you're going to do this for the long term. Otherwise, it is not sustainable if you're not yourself, if you have like a personified character of yourself. This is a different version of myself. It's maybe like a bit more active and upbeat, but it's still me, still genuinely my thoughts. It's authentically myself. If I was someone else, this would be very, very draining. And I feel like I would resent that character that's on camera that is not me. So don't do that. Any more don'ts, any more do's? Just try it out. I feel like maybe that's my general advice. Almost always, just try it out. Get that practical experience. Theoretical knowledge will always also flow based on practical experience. If you really enjoy it, you'll start down rabbit holes on how to improve your stuff, how to do it better, and do it over and over and over again until all of a sudden you're episode 130 in front of a microphone, talking to a camera, in front of people, kind of in front of people, people listening to that. Yeah, that's what happened to me. So,
do it!
Yeah, just do it.
Just do it!
That's fun. What would you tell tech folks considering breaking into the content creation space? And I'm going to combine that with how can developers get out of their comfort zone to create content and share knowledge that way? Now, if people are considering breaking into the content creation space, just try it. Figure out what you like creating. Figure out what you like consuming. If it's video form content, try and create a tutorial on video. If it's a podcast, try hop on a conversation with someone, your colleague or your friend, and record that podcast. If you consume a lot of newsletters or blogs, try contributing. Write up your own thoughts on paper. Try and structure it. Ask for feedback. There's very low barrier of entry for delivering content. Creating really high quality content is going to require time and experience. But the only way to do that is to truly enjoy creating in the first place. I feel like if you want to create a blog, write down your thoughts on paper, ask a friend or colleague for a review, just publish it. People will give you feedback, or they might not. You might not have any people reading your blog within the first few weeks, but at some point people will stumble upon a problem and your blog might pop up. So then they'll consume it and all of a sudden it goes viral and you get feedback like, man, I love the content, but the structure sucks. And you can adopt that feedback and then create a better blog and create that again. And all of a sudden you'll find yourself not being a software developer anymore, but a writer, which I've had conversations with people that have had that journey, which to me is phenomenal, because that means a small seed like you writing a blog, doing that again and finding true enjoyment in doing that and starting a newsletter. And at some point allowing yourself to do that as a full-time job. And then you're not a software engineer anymore. You're a writer. Like, that sounds like a movie to me. In a very tech savvy movie, a very tech savvy movie world, that would be a movie. And the journey is amazing. Just the fact that we can do that. Now, when it comes to your comfort zone, that's a hard one, because I never realized that I'm going to put myself on camera, I'm going to talk and people are going to listen to it. I thought it would be fun to do. So then I did it. If that is kind of haunting you, if that is daunting, you don't have to release it immediately. You can release it within your inner circles. You can ask feedback over and over and over again until you have a comfort level that you can put your episodes out there, put your blog out there. But honestly, I don't think I would recommend it. I would say just do it. Like, that's the easiest, simplest solution. This community is very, accepts everyone, anyone and everyone with open arms and feedback. It's not from a place of prejudice. It's genuinely from a place of elevating the content, elevating the quality, helping the writer create better content, helping the podcaster create better podcasts. No one has ever told me that they hate my podcasts just for X, Y, and Z. They've always said, well, a lot of the times I get your SEO score sucks. But other than that, people have said, well, this is just a bit too long of a format for me. I would love 30-minute episodes. Or the intro was too long, so we cut down the intro. The 30-minute example, like, there's a mismatch in what I want to do versus what they want to consume. But it's always based on elevating the content, making it more tailor-made to what the people need. And that's not from a bad place. That's never negative feedback. It's always just feedback, objective feedback. And you can choose as the content creator to adopt it and to listen to that feedback, or to have your own vision and be like, well, I understand the feedback, but this is the route we're going based on X, Y, and Z. I feel like it's hard to get out of your comfort zone, but that is also where you learn the most. So maybe that should be kind of your driver. You want to grow, you want to be a writer. Even if you don't, you think you might want to, or you might enjoy this, then start doing it. You don't have to release it. Start doing it for yourself and do it over and over and over again. Even if you do it a year without releasing any content, I'm sure you would be able to write a book and it will be a solid book down the line because you put in the work and effort. There was a quote, I think somewhere from an anime, that accumulated effort has a certain level of beauty, which talent does not have. And accumulated effort only comes through accumulated effort. You have to do something and you have to do it consistently, and you have to be able to reflect and improve on that as well. And then at the end, if you do that for a whole year, you'll be phenomenal at whatever you want to do. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sending me your questions. This was Q&A number 6, which means we've done 6 rounds, and I'm really proud of that. Episode number 130. If you've enjoyed it, if you have more questions for the next one, feel free to drop them in the comments below. Send me a direct message on LinkedIn or Twitter, because I always look at that for the questions. That's where all of these questions came from as well. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one.